I always say your struggle is a page in somebody's survival guide. And what that does is empowers them to actually go, you know what, I'm going to use this to my advantage. And, you know, not only does it get them out of the house and give them purpose and distraction, but it also makes sense of their illness. And for them to see that they're helping other people, there's no feeling like it. There is no feeling in the world seeing somebody become well because of your help. And that's what I give them, that power.
Hello, and you're very welcome to another episode of the Life Well Lived podcast with me, Shane Breslin. My guest on this week's episode of the show, and the owner of the voice you've heard just now, is Caroline McMenamin from Derry in the north of Ireland. Caroline McMenamin is a really, really fascinating individual and somebody that I've been paying attention to for quite some time online through her various work on social media, on LinkedIn and Instagram, amongst others. Her story is a fascinating one. She, in her own words, has dealt with a mental health disorder from the age of 4. And we go through that a lot on this episode of the show. She was diagnosed eventually with OCD and treated at the age of 21. But she has very, very stark and vivid memories of how OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, had manifested itself in her childhood going way back to the age of 4. Caroline has taken her experiences forward into the workplace with her venture Replenish, which aims to create a positive mental health culture in workplaces, schools and communities throughout Ireland and overseas through consultancy, workshops and events. We talked about a wide range of subject matters in this episode, including Caroline's experiences with OCD and going back to college to study integrative counselling and eventually becoming an integrative counsellor specialising in CBT, cognitive behavioural therapies. We also talked about the role that transgenerational trauma can play in our lives. We talked about medication and the part that it plays in the treatment of mental health conditions. And Caroline spoke bravely and openly about her own suicidal ideation in her earlier years and why she no longer now fears death. I really hope you get as much out of this conversation as I did. I really enjoyed it. She is an impressive individual and the world is really her oyster, and I've no doubt that we'll be hearing a lot more about Caroline McMenamin and her Replenish venture in the months and years to come. So without further ado, on to this week's show and my interview with Caroline McMenamin. Caroline McMenamin, thank you so much for joining me on the show today. I'm really, really grateful and looking forward to hearing more about your background and your story and what you're up to now.
Thanks for having me. It's an honour.
Excellent. If we start maybe from the start, and I read one interview that you gave where you said that you had dealt with OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, since the age of 4 until you were diagnosed and treated at the age of 21. What were the hallmarks of OCD for you? That's effectively all your childhood, all your adolescence, teenage years, right up into university, I'm assuming. What were the hallmarks of it? What were the effects that OCD had on your life back then?
Well, with hindsight, I'm able to see that my obsession with having my shoelace tied really, 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 really tight at the age of 4 was, you know, an indication of obsessive compulsive disorder. But my parents were of the generation where nobody really knew how to deal with mental health issues in their children, let alone detect them. And that's basically because they were in the hangover of a generation where that generation just experienced, you know, the abolition of the Lunacy Act and the shutdown of asylums. So whilst there was a huge change from like institution to community care, there was still that hangover of stigma and lack of education. So had I had an earlier diagnosis from my parents being educated, you know, maybe I would have suffered less. But yeah, back when I was around 4, sitting on the mat going to school, I didn't like the idea of my foot slipping out of my shoe. I just didn't like it. So I would sit for about 2 hours until I was dragged out the door, trying to make sure my shoe was so tight that my foot wouldn't slip a bit. And it was an obsession, like, but I'm only able to recognize that in recent years, you know, but at the time nobody knew. They probably just thought it was a redheaded child with a bad temper.
Yeah. And that was one incident or type of memory that you have of the obsessiveness that you had, that to have things just so or just perfect before you left for school in the morning.
Were there any others, or how did the condition affect you or manifest itself in other instances?
It was always there. So people say, you know, was it a trigger? Was it a trauma? It was always there. It's your biopsychosocial, and it was just a combination, and I was just predisposed. So it was genetic. It was genetic makeup, and it just got worse and worse as I got older, because you become more conscious of the environment around you and more things terrify you. But I was always an anxious child. I would have worried about bad things happening. I would be very obsessive to the point where I would avoid certain things. I would have different obsessions. Even in my young age, I would have different obsessions that were innocuous for that age. But for me at that time, it was very hard. So for example, I would worry about bad things happening. And my mother, being quite an overprotective mother, which is normal, was very much about checking. Did you say your prayers? Did you check for you have your bus money or your canteen money? Have you got your school bag? Look left and right. And you can see how those checks really I absorbed, to the point then that it really added to my OCD manifestation later on in life. Now, it wasn't the sole reason, but it was a contribution to the need for checking and the need for making things okay. But that was just a mother being overprotective, and just a child who was already predisposed to obsessing about numerous different things. So my head was a constant whirlwind. And you would see back in home videos, you know, for around Christmas and things like that. There's one video where I'm a flower girl at a wedding, and I'm trailing behind everyone because my shoe lift is open, because I've obviously sat and tried to make really tight, even on that wedding day when I had duties as a flower girl. And then in another Christmas video, you can see my sister with the camcorder, and she goes out into the kitchen, and I'm about 5, and I'm just standing there staring into space, clearly ruminating on whatever my young mind was dwelling on. So it was there even before I was aware that it was there.
That's amazing. I haven't thought of kind of video evidence, I guess, is what you've just spoken about. How does it make you feel to look back and see yourself as a young child in going through stuff that maybe you've no memory of the detail right now, but going through stuff clearly?
It is quite poignant, because I wouldn't say it robbed me of my childhood, but, you know, little did I know the suffering I would endure from that age onwards. You know, it was from aged 8 when I probably moved house up to where I live now. It kind of, my childhood, I would say, ended there, purely because it was a stressful time, and stress, as we know, is a big trigger for any existing mental health issue. So when I was about 8, I went through my first real bad episode of anxiety, and I would dare say depression. Now, some people are like, oh, how could an 8-year-old be depressed? But, you know, I had an off low mood. It was already there, and the moving house from my best friend and from my normal environment was a huge trigger. So basically change really triggered my first episode of unwellness, basically, to the point where I would describe it then for the next couple of years as, mommy, I have that bad feeling again. And again, parents not being educated in mental health, no parents for that matter were educated in mental health. Mommy would go, well, you know, that's okay, or it's probably trapped wind, or hay fever would make you anxious. And even to this day, I go, I wonder if I'm feeling anxious because it's hay fever. Or even when people say to me being a therapist now, sometimes I will hear myself going, but you do know trapped wind can make you feel a bit off. And that's just basically from what my mum told me, and it stuck. But from looking back, I'm kind of more proud of the person I am now, because if I had a child and he or she's a replication of me, then I'm more able to be dealing with them, and I'm more equipped. In fact, I'm ready, you know, to intervene when I should I have children in the near future. But I always say I'm the person I needed when I was younger. So I kind of let that kind of not tinge looking back on my life. I see it as a blessing. I had to endure the hells of it before I had to really see that it conditioned me to be someone who could help someone like that young child I was.
Yeah, it's powerful stuff to think back then, to think that somebody so young could be affected by something so severe and so serious, and how that can affect so many people. And just talking about kind of the stressors of the environmental stressors effectively of maybe something as simple as moving home, I'm sure there were other, like you grew up in Derry in probably the latter stages of the Troubles. Yeah. Do you ever think that there was a connection, or do you think, were you kind of well shielded from those instances?
OG Derry girl. I think there's that, you know, phenomenon of transgenerational trauma where, you know, I wouldn't have to have had dealt with it directly, but the indirect effect of the Troubles can have effect on young children of people who were subjected to the Troubles. So it has that cellular memory, transgenerational trauma. There's that whole scientific argument. But, you know, yes, in the latter stages of the Troubles, but I very much remember bomb scares left, right and centre, running. I remember one specific memory was people running from the town up the quay, up the back of the quay beside the river. And I remember that so clearly. And my cousin's shoe fell off. And it was like, do I go back and help her with her shoe or do I run on? And, you know, even to this day now where I go out, one of the intrusive thoughts I would have is there's going to be a bomb here, or this is an easy place for someone to get a bomb in or a shooting. And that is already there. It's pre-existing, but it's then triggered more than by what you see or hear in the news. So somebody with anxiety like me will obsess over these things happening, where somebody without anxiety won't obsess as much. But yeah, I would dare say the Troubles had a huge impact on even today, where I would be quite cautious of cars slowing down and the windows rolling down. My first reaction is to duck. You know, and that's, yes, the Troubles, but also what you see in the news, like I said. But that fear of the police, that fear of rioting, and more so the fear of bombs, if anything, was probably weighed enough on me to kind of impact on my mental health.
Yeah.
And also the whole, I would dare say there's that divide between men and women, but there's also a divide between Catholic Irish women. Like, you hear people in America talking about the most misrepresented woman in America is the black woman. But I also say, what about the Irish Catholic female? You know, nobody really looks at her. And even she herself doesn't look at her, because she's conditioned to get on with it and to be like the person that everyone goes to. And I think there's a lack of recognition on that. So there's this moral duty and social obligation to care for everyone. That pressure is also still there, to the point where I'm in constant conflict over, do I take up new opportunities now, or do I adhere to the rule that my parents and my mum fulfilled when they were younger? So there's a lot of social restraints and long-standing impressions that do affect everybody, but more so people with mental health, because, you know, with regards to OCD, there's this moral code that is very strict within our psyche. And if we deviate from that, it's almost, you know, an indication that we're a bad person, and it could trigger our OCD worse or peak it.
I get that entirely. As a man who lives in rural Ireland and from an agricultural background, I guess, on kind of a couple of sides of the family, as almost everybody in rural Ireland is at some level, to never have had any desire or interest in going in that direction with my own life. And also how to be, you talked about kind of moral duty, I think was the words you used. I recognize that entirely, and how we show up in the world as truly ourselves and not a version of ourselves that might fit with our surroundings is definitely that there's a lot there. And what you said about transgenerational trauma is something I've thought about a lot in terms of, even just in terms of Irish people and, like, you know, the famine, the Troubles, obviously, and the violence that has been on this island within the last 100 years, I guess. But even going back to the famine and the trauma of, you know, a million people leaving the country and a million people dying, I think was borderline those sort of numbers. But like and that's only 4 generations ago or so. It's my grandfather's grandfather would have been exposed to that. I would have been very familiar with that at first-hand basis. So yeah, no, I think there's a lot to that transgenerational trauma side of things too.
Yeah, the other side of it is that, you know, we get dairy gears out of it because one of the ways we coped with the trauma was our humour, and that has now become almost like a subculture. But also too, at the same time, what I found was my long endurance of mental ill health made me more intolerant of things that weren't true to myself. So I found myself being nonconformist to what my other friends around me were doing. And yes, I was probably ostracized for being different, but you know, the upside of having a mental health condition is that you really get a lot of self-insight. And had I not dealt with a mental health issue, you know, maybe I would be more impressionable now. But because I really had to go to the depths of myself and I had to look at the darkness, you know, I know what I'm about and I know what I'm not about. And I have a strict intolerance or a no tolerance policy of anything that doesn't serve me or anything that doesn't fulfill me in terms of principles and values.
So that's something that I've only done. I'm 41, so I'm a good bit older than you, but that's something that I've only done and stumbled upon effectively by accident in terms of, you know, personal values and personal value systems in the last 2 years or so. Did you do that as a conscious exercise? How did you end up doing that? You know, that self-insight, and you talked about the darkness of looking inside at your own darkness. When did you approach that, or how did you go about it?
There's so many factors that have added up to that point where I got a lot of self-insight, to the point that, you know, what made me go, you know what, this mental health disorder was for a reason and I value it now. Because what happened was, from adolescence up, you know, you're most impressionable, your basic need, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you want to feel fulfilled, so you be part of a group and you kind of strip your identity to become part of this group. So you become a clone, basically. And I just couldn't fit in. As my mental health deteriorated, the more stronger my true self became. And I would do a lot of work on the authentic self with my clients and in my workshops and things like that, because I have this, they think I'm really weird, but when they're going through a hard time, I get excited for them because this, I say to them, this is where you really get to know yourself. And they're terrified and they look at me with wide eyes. And I'd be like, this happened to me at a young age. And what I realized was I had no time for pretenses. My mental energy was so much focused on keeping myself well that, you know, I had little attention elsewhere. And so it was more comfortable for me to just do what came naturally, aka my authentic self. So as I got older, within probably around 14, 15, I started to really just own what I was about. I started to lose value for what people thought of me, because it's that great quote, you know, you go into a room and you wonder what people think about you, but now you come to a stage where you wonder, do you like those people when you walk in their room? And I think that was the kind of turning point where I started to see people as, what would you know? You have not endured what I've gone through. I started to value my experience and I started to see the value of applying that in my own life. So I was started to do things that matter to me, and I changed. I started to wear my leather jacket. I listened to my rock music. I know I was unapologetic for a change. And yes, some people came away, but the people who were most in tune with me came along. And I started to see that the more I was vocal and unapologetic about myself, the more the like-minded people I attracted. And even though some people weren't my level, they respected, you know, who I was. Because I started to become a bit more vocal, I realized that I had escalated ahead because I educated myself on mental health. I probably was a bit more emotionally mature because I had to endure such unwellness at such a young age. So I was a wee bit more mature than the average girl my age. So I started to see the value of not going along with the crowd, but focusing on myself. And, you know, when I first met my boyfriend, one of the first things he said to me was, I've never met someone so sure of themselves. And I always say, well, you know, I had a fight for that. And it's kind of like a byproduct of living with a mental health disorder, because you're constantly focusing on the self, the self, the self. And whilst you're doing that, you get to really know yourself and you become not afraid of it. There's people out there and they numb themselves from looking inward. People are terrified of seeing what lies in their depth because they're afraid of what they find. So they numb themselves with alcohol, with distraction, with social media. Whereas when you're unwell, you've no other option other than to dive in and go, this is what I'm about and here's what I have to do. And then you don't become afraid of yourself. And then you get that insight into going, this is me, here's what I'm about. It's not all pretty, but I'm not afraid of it. And you become more confident in yourself. Where there's people out there who would become mainstream because it's easier to follow a model or a crowd as opposed to take the work or do the work and really get to know themselves. And I think therapy really helped me with that. My cognitive behavioral therapy, when I got diagnosed at 21, that helped me a lot. So I didn't have much time for anything that didn't matter, and I'm still the same to this very day. So I've been conditioned to deal with adverse conditions, and you know, I'm not aversive to, you know, hard work and endurance, because I've been thrown into that anyway. So I start to look at the things that I could do that maybe some people wouldn't be able to do because they don't have that resilience, but I know I could do because I have that resilience, and that's all thanks to my mental health disorder, which is the 10th most debilitating disorder in the world, but I wouldn't change it.
It's a phenomenal revelation to have at such a young age. So, and to react in the way you did, clearly, I commend you for that, because I think a lot of other people would not have maybe even the clarity of thought to see it in that way, and yeah, to see it as something. And like, I've used the words in the last 2 years since I started this journey of talking and speaking and writing about depression. I have used the words that I'm grateful for my depression, because it showed me things that were wrong and that needed to change, and it showed me a way. So I approach whenever I have those dips, I still have them quite regularly, and in the last few months I've had one that was as deep as I've probably ever had in the 25 years that I've kind of been cognizant of dealing with depression. But I'm grateful for it, and I'm paying attention to it, and it does help me to see what's wrong and what needs to be fixed. So it is weird. I don't know. I don't expect a lot of people to understand if I say that I'm grateful for my depression. But it is interesting to hear you speak about your OCD and other mental health challenges in a similar way.
It's interesting that you say that too, because some people probably think I'm a bit morbid in my outlook, but I think that because I felt suicidal before, you know, you feel close to death. Death is perceived as a solution in some cases. But at the same time too, it helped me develop a realistic perspective where I'm not afraid of death, to the point then, you know, how that benefited me was that I was able to successfully treat a client with death anxiety a couple of weeks ago, purely because I didn't have a fear of death. It's kind of like an unconscious collective fear that we all have. But because I've entertained that thought so much, it doesn't scare me no more. I've exposed to the ideology of death over and over and over again through my worst times, to the point now where, you know, it doesn't scare me, and it actually has equipped me to be a better therapist, to the point where, you know, some therapists wouldn't be able to deal with a client who is presenting with death anxiety, because it's quite an existential kind of approach that not many people have developed. But because of my own times of suicidal feelings, it equipped me to be able to have a conversation that allowed that person to be exposed to what she was developing a phobia of. And within 6 weeks, she was a completely different person. And so that's where another element of where, you know, the point where I wanted to die. And I flirted with the idea of death numerous times, to the point where it doesn't scare me, has actually really helped me in my work. So there was like a dark, morbid humor there.
Yeah, no.
So you can see which way you want, but, you know, some people would say it's controversial, but I just think it's more matter of fact.
Without a doubt. Like, I would say it is exactly as that. And like, I want to get into your current work. No, no, it's totally fine. But you've brought up about the suicidality, I guess. Talk to us a little bit about your experiences with that. How close were you, and what might have got you out of that?
Well, I think to really give context, I think the nature of my OCD would be fair to start with. For example, you know, OCD presents in many forms. Many people think it's cleanliness and order. That's just scratching the surface of it, when in fact my OCD is very much about intrusive thoughts. So I would have very little compulsions, to the point where you wouldn't see me having any compulsions, but my thoughts were very intrusive. So it would be thoughts of responsibility. And that manifested because when I was 8 and I moved up to this new house, I had my dog and she was 10, and she had come from the old street with us as well. And she was just, you know, in the council estate, your dog ran riot, right? Everybody knew everybody's dog, right? But up here then it was more quiet and private. And Tandy, the dog, wasn't used to being in a new environment. And we walked up the road this one evening in September, and it was very dark and there was a busy road. And Tandy, being a dog, saw another dog across the street and across the road and ran over and got hit twice, and I saw it and heard it. And from that was the moment my OCD really manifested, because what happened then was I developed this, I internalized it as I'm responsible. So unconsciously internalized it as I'm responsible. So then you would find then I was very overprotective then of people around me. I made sure I didn't do anything that would deem me responsible, or worse, irresponsible. So I started to chip plugs out of the walls because I didn't want there to be an electrical fire. And so it was my duty, my responsibility to keep people safe. And so you can see how that trauma of seeing my dog getting knocked down really was the point where OCD really came into itself. But then I started to watch things on the news, people, and then horror stories and horror movies, you know, people become possessed and they kill their families, or people losing control and doing something bad, people becoming sexual predators, people becoming psychotic. And it wasn't all, oh, I'm afraid this is going to happen to me. It was more, I'm afraid I'm going to do this, because it all came from I would be responsible. So the kind of thoughts then would come into my head were would be twisted, dark thoughts. And you usually find people with OCD and anxiety have the most vivid and illustrated imagination. So you'd be sitting doing one thing and then the most obscene image would come into your head and it would make you sick with fear and anxiety. But it wouldn't be just images, because the way OCD works and how your body reacts to fear and anxiety, the whole body would react. And it would be reacting out of fear, but you would be thinking that your body wanted to do it, that you wanted to fulfill this urge of just lifting a knife and killing your mother as she stood ironing beside you. Or, you know, it felt very vivid. So the suicide came as a result of that, the suicidology, the suicide ideation, where I thought I'd rather die than do this. And this was before I got diagnosed. So the idea of doing it was really, really bad. And so I thought, I would rather die than actually bring shame to my family and go through with these things. So I would think about it, but I never actually had any even self-harming behavior. Or what I always wanted to do was an accident to happen to me, so I wouldn't have to actually do anything myself, because I didn't want mommy and daddy to think, oh, she ended her life. It would have been easier for me to go had it been an accident. But of course, accidents, no, they don't happen when you want them to happen. And I would do small things, like I didn't think I was worthy of eating, so I pretended I ate and just left the plate there as if I had cleaned it. But I just didn't see myself worthy of eating because I was having these bad thoughts. Now, that could have manifested into an eating disorder, but it didn't, because at the same time I was quite aware deep down inside that these thoughts weren't indicative of the person I was, but it was impeding on my ability to function. So by the time I was 21, a main stressor that happened was my sister was diagnosed with preeclampsia and her wee baby was born premature. Now he's 8 now and he's 9 in June, but you know, they're fine. But at that time it was huge. And that's where I went to the doctor and I said, look, I need help. And doctors have a small percentage of their training in mental health. So this doctor was like, oh, do you do exercise? Do you do healthy? And by this stage, I have been on anti-anxiety medication since the age of 15, 16. And I was now 21 and I was at the worst I'd ever been. And I went back to the same doctor going, I really need help. And again, he just sent me away. And then I went back to my usual doctor, the female doctor, and I said, look, I need help. And so she gave me the BDI form, which is the Beacon Depression Inventory. And I knew I had a really, like, even if I was a number 3 on the score from 1 to 5, 5 being the worst, I would pick 5, 5, 5, 5 the whole way down, because I knew, for my family's sake as well as my own sake, I needed help. And I went, I got an appointment with Old Bridge House, which is psychological therapies over here in Derry, over in the Waterside. And I remember getting that letter and it was like a psychiatric assessment. And I thought, oh, here's where I get locked up. But at that stage, I was so much in agony. I had to tell someone, I had to get it out of me. So before I went and got that, I got that assessment and it was sitting in a dingy dark room, you know, lack of funding in the NHS, and it was a male social worker, but I just told him everything. I was convinced they had a big red button under his desk that he would have to press when I said something that was totally obscene, but he didn't. Mm-hmm. And then I graduated with my degree in drama. And the next day I got a letter, a yellow letter from the place where I had my assessment, and on it was more or less saying, after consultation with our in-house psychiatrist, we diagnose you with OCD, a common disorder. We're going to start you on the specific medication. And when you are at a certain level or dosage, we're going to start you on CBT. And I swear, you would think somebody handed me a lottery ticket or something better than my degree, because for once, this was somebody saying to me, see all those thoughts you have? It's normal. Everybody gets them. You just obsess over why you get them. And it was like a miracle, and I never looked back. It's just a shame I had a love so long in agony before I got diagnosed, but that's what I try to do now, change the culture where people are quicker to identify where they can intervene.
Yeah, there's probably about six things you said there that I could delve deeper into. One of them was the idea of the representation of mental health in kind of popular culture and in movies and books or whatever, and the impact that that has on the way people with identified mental health illnesses or mental health conditions, whatever we might call it, are treated or are considered in society, I suppose. And it's something that I rail against. It really, really annoys me when, you know, for instance, we had down in South, in the Republic of Ireland, there was the case of murder-suicide, and there was talk of the mental health and mental health problems that the murderer had, and that he dealt with depression. And it was like, it just really got my back up in terms of, like, I don't, just in terms of the drawing those dots between an incredibly violent act and depression. And I just don't get that. Yeah. I talk about depression a lot, and when I've no doubt that there are people out there who maybe trust me less since I've started speaking about it. Yeah. I also believe that there are other people, given that I am now fully owning it and fully, like, you know, being fully transparent and the height of integrity and honesty in everything I do, that there are definitely people who maybe trust me more, or I have built relationships since I started, lots of relationships since I started speaking about this. But I'm just interested in your thoughts on the representation of mental health and mental health conditions in the popular culture or the media, and what connection have you felt that in terms of the so-called stigma around mental health? What are your thoughts on all that?
I remember specifically doing a YouTube video, and the name or the title was it, So I'm a Psycho? ? And when I started with saying Andrea Lubitz was accused of having mental health disorders, and that was the reason why he flew the plane into the French Alps on the way back from Barcelona. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do remember it well. Yeah, yeah.
And on the headlines about him was depression. And on the video I said, so because I have a mental health disorder, I'm therefore deemed to be a psychopath or to do something harmful. And then my argument was, mental health disorders are not synonymous with psychopathy. And it's important for people to realize that some people are bad and some people may have psychosis, but the majority of people who have psychosis are not murderers. In fact, they're more harmless. And with regards to OCD and depression, they're in the neurosis side. You know, they're further away from the psychosis side. And I thought, you know, here I am trying to justify me having a mental illness purely because I don't want to be tarnished by how the media have scaremongered people into thinking that if you have depression, then you're automatically going to kill somebody. And no wonder then people don't speak out. You know, no wonder then people go and take their own lives, because they don't want to go and think, oh, I was diagnosed with depression, that means I'm more likely to do X, Y, and Z. And, you know, people are under that impression. And I always, when I do talks, I always go on and I dress up, and then I always go, you will have had your opinion of me. And then I go, but I'm about to change your opinion of me right now. And I'll tell you that I have the 10th most debilitating disorder in the world. And then I go, I know now that you're more scared of me. And then I go into how and why the media scaremongers and how that tarnishing of mental health has really inhibited people from stepping forward and owning their issues. But, you know, on the sideline, I do be like, you know, I have OCD, but it doesn't mean I want to do these things. In fact, it's the opposite of what I want to do. But like, if I sat and educated people on the depths of how disturbing OCD can get, sometimes the ignorance of people or their unwillingness to learn keeps them in that contain place where stigma exists. So it's the responsibility of the people around us to really delve into understanding mental health. So that's why a lot of what I do is education-based, and I use myself as a case study. So when I run workshops, I go back and I tell them how it manifested, and I give them insight into how it affects people differently, not just OCD, but anxiety and depression and the kind of phobias. And there's a great book, absolutely brilliant book by a guy called David Adam. And he has OCD, and it's called The Man Who Couldn't Stop. And some of the case studies, they're that abstract and absurd. They're funny, but they're not funny for the person who's dealing with it. And when you do kind of take snippets out of that book, obviously the initial thing to do is to laugh, because it is so weird and out there, but it's not very weird for the person dealing with it. So in all its gory details and dark, twisted, sadistic nature, it's still important to educate on OCD, the likes of how depression will make someone want to end their life, or we're so cushioned from the realities of mental health that it's very hush-hush. But I often find the shock factor is helpful, and people wouldn't look at me if I was wearing average clothes. So I make a point of dressing up and looking as glamorous as I can when I'm doing a workshop. And then I hit them then with, I nearly wanted to end my life. I have this, I take this medication, because for them, they're getting to see, oh shit, here's somebody who I would have never thought would have been suicidal or lives with a really chronic disorder. So for them, what I want them to do is to tilt their head and to see the world around them with a different perspective. And so if I have to use myself to do that, then so be it.
Yes. There's so much there. I'm not even sure exactly where to, the amount of thoughts that it sparked. One of the things that I was thinking as you were speaking, and I've been practicing listening, so I was trying not to think while you were speaking. But I do that too.
I bought on because I'm afraid of forgetting.
But one of the things I was thinking about was the general human condition. And I think I'll kind of couch this in maybe starting a question or discussion about medication, because I know that you've spoken about medication. You've spoken about the medication that you've taken, and that some people see medication as a form of defeat, and that you don't. You said that it has helped you to be more yourself. My difficulty with medication is how quickly I was prescribed it. So you talked about your doctor who asked lots of questions about your lifestyle before kind of going down the more kind of pronounced forms of treatment. I didn't have that at all. So I was recommended antidepressants within, 10, 15 minutes in a doctor's office. And that happened to me on a couple of occasions before I insisted upon talking to somebody and insisted upon going alternative routes to finding out more about what depression was, how it manifests itself, how, serotonin deficiencies, all of that. And it was the first time I heard, one of the things that I have done over the last 2 years was to take a real microscope to my diet and nutrition. And first time I heard any connections between of the proven scientific connection between your gut health and your mental health was from a nutritional therapist. And I had never heard a medical doctor talk about that. And I think it's fairly well established at this stage. And certainly when I changed my diet and when I removed certain things from my diet, my energy, my mood, and everything stabilized more so than it had ever stabilized before. So I'm not anti-medication, but I have a lot of problems with the way that medication is doled out in so many cases many people. And I've heard somebody, and I can't remember exactly who it was, but I've heard somebody describe the way that depression and anxiety and other mental health conditions and disorders are treated. I've heard them being described as the pathologization of the human condition. So effectively, we are all human. You've spoken about the thoughts, the morbid thoughts, maybe obscene thoughts that you had, and that the day that you felt that this was normal, and what you could address was the way you were thinking about it, the way you were obsessing about it, that I completely recognize that. And I think that the challenge really is, the way I see it, and I'm interested to hear your thoughts, that the challenge, I think, is the challenge of being human and the difficulties of being human. And we all respond to those challenges and struggles and troubles in different ways. And a certain percentage of those are labeled or maybe unhelpfully, in an unhelpful way, categorized as you know, something is wrong with you, or, and that person over there, something is wrong with them, and yeah. all the other people, the other 70% of people over here, they're okay. Whereas I see it just as much more, in a much more kind of bigger picture way.
Yeah, I understand that. Because I say to people, you know, like your body is going to get run down or your immune system is going to become depleted. So too is your mental health. You know, some people find that more difficult to handle because it doesn't feel right and they feel like they can't cope. But back to what you were saying there about your medication, I've realized in the last few years, and this is why my tagline to Replenish is called Acting on Mental Health, because what I talk about is, you know, therapy, medication is not the one-off solution. Your mental health well-being is a combination of small steps. So in my workshops, I will get nutritionists. Last week, I had a nutritionist on there, a nutritionist called Jade. Her tagline is Made by Jade. She primarily looked at the gut-mind connection and how your gut is your second brain. And then this week in my workshop, I'm having a complementary therapist. And then the following week, I'm having a pharmacist. And then I will bring in an occupational therapist and then people who will be an advocate for yoga, because these are the kind of things that keep me well. And you know, it's a combination of all of them combined that keeps us well. So what I do then is I would talk a lot about doing things, you know, like a self-care plan. So for example, I would say in the morning I get up and I check my medication, but I also check my vitamins, because see, before I took my vitamins, I wasn't as stable as I am now that I checked my vitamins. So I did my research and, you know, vitamin B complex, vitamin D, which is my holy grail, my magnesium, and a probiotic to change the bacteria in my stomach so it influences then my brain. Since taking those medications, my bad days have become more infrequent to the point where I'm like suspicious. I'm like, okay, what's going on here? I'm suspiciously okay. So I've realized through getting other people to educate me that, you know, it's so much more. So my self-care plan is getting up, I go to the gym. So in the winter, I would go to the gym and do my exercise. But then in the summer, you know, purely because of nature and the, you know, therapeutic properties of nature and the sea, I would go out and run in nature. And then I would go and do yoga. And then I would come home and I would take all my vitamins. Because I'm vegetarian, I also make sure I have to supplement my iron intake. And then I take my medication along with my vitamins. Now, I understand that medication isn't for everyone, and that's okay. That's fine. It's just sometimes you find people with OCD, they tend to continue going on it when they come off it. And that's okay. You know, maybe there will be a stage where I can come off it, but, you know, at the same time, medication helps me be more me. And if there is something that can help me, then by God, I'm going to take it, despite the negative side effects or whatever. I'm lucky to never have had any major side effects. But as I said, your self-care plan is what I encourage my clients and my workshop clients to develop. And what I do is I help facilitate that by bringing in different contracted professionals, because what I'm trying to get them to see that it's not just therapy and it's not just what I say. It's your diet, it's your environment, it's your exercise routine, it's the way you speak to yourself, it's the people you surround yourself with, it's the books you read, it's everything, it's the music you listen to. Especially if you're a HSP, which is like a highly sensitive person, you're very receptive to your surroundings. And so, for example, I would consider myself a very highly sensitive person, so that's why I complain a lot, because I'm either cold or the light's too bright, because my mood can become very easily affected. So I make it my business to make sure I'm in the best environment for my mental health. And that's what is I try to instill into my clients, that you have to be unapologetic about your self-care, and that self-care isn't selfish. It's absolutely necessary, because only when I started to embark on really upping my self-care, that only then did I really become well and stable.
I love that whole approach. It is, like, in a nutshell, I guess, quite a close mirror to the way that I've approached things as well, and that I've found that works. And I think that what you're saying, I would agree wholeheartedly in terms of the way treatment is, that there's more than just therapy and medication. And I see a lot of people who, I think it's perception and education maybe, and more people speak about it, the better, because I see a lot of people who feel there's something wrong with me, and the tablet a day or whatever it is helps me to live, and then I can just do whatever. I take the tablet a day, and then I can do whatever else I want because there's something wrong with me. And I just would encourage people to think about things differently and think about things in a more holistic way, because there's nothing wrong. Like, to me, depression, anxiety, OCD, whatever it is, I don't see that as something wrong. I think that's just a manifestation of our individuality and who we are.
Yeah,
as a person.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I do want to get into your current work. We could talk all day, I guess, and that's
another thing. Yeah, I know, it's a word. I go on and on. I'm sorry.
I'm like that too. So your current work, I know you went back to college, you did your degree in integrative counselling, and you also did study CBT. Is 100% of Caroline McMenamin now in Replenish? What's your current work? Tell me a little bit about what you're up to right now.
I could never work for other people because I was too busy twiddling my thumbs. I remember working as a youth development officer in an ICT kind of environment, and I was always putting up posters about mental health and this and mental health that, because it was youth, and I thought, you know, youth of all people need, you know, if I could have any or make any difference, I will. And then I just thought, you know, no amount of money can fulfill me. I have to do what I want to do. So I decided to go out on my own. With the Red Duchess is my, obviously, my blog name. And I developed that when I was about 17, 18. And it was your usual blog talking about inane things. And again, didn't fulfill me. So I decided to become very vocal about my mental health. And I found that brought a lot of people forward to open up to me. And I realized, you know, there's something in this. And not only, like, did I enjoy having, like, clients, but I also liked empowering people to help themselves. So for example, I developed Replenish as an educational way to bring about mental health awareness. So in a very non-clinical way, that's why it's kind of based around the sea and the ocean. And I'm very informal in when I talk to people, and I find that really, you know, dissolves the clinical side to mental health. So in my workshops then I would, you know, people go, oh, I have anxiety. And I go, what is anxiety? What is it? And people can't answer me. So what I do, I go back and look and I tell them, you know, sometimes we fear what we don't understand. That's why we have racism. That's why we have discrimination, because we don't understand other people's cultures. And we stigmatize mental health because we don't understand how it works. So what I do, the first thing I ever do is educate them on what anxiety is. It's fear that has become distorted. It's a primal instinct. It actually saves us. A panic attack is your body trying to save itself, so it's not going to hurt you. And once people then become accustomed to going, you know what, that's not as scary as I thought, they're empowering themselves then rather than me having all the answers. And in my workshops too, I get people to use their own story. So I go, look, I don't have experience of postnatal depression or PTSD, but you do. Do you want to run a workshop in your location? So that's why now when I did workshops in Sligo and Dublin, there's people from those workshops now who run my support groups, which are called the Replenish Tribes. And what that does is empower them to see that their mental health isn't their downfall, but actually their breaking is their making. And I always say your struggle is a page in somebody's survival guide. And what that does is empowers them to actually go, you know what, I'm going to use this to my advantage. And, you know, not only does it get them out of the house and give them purpose and distraction, but it also makes sense of their illness. And for them to see that they're helping other people, there's no feeling like it. There is no feeling in the world seeing somebody become well because of your help. And that's what I give them, that power. And I always say, with Replenish, I run a communist regime because there's no hierarchy, because I don't know it all. And the day I say I do, then I really need to get my head checked again for the second time. But what I do is I ask people to educate me. Tell me what postnatal depression is. Somebody comes to me and goes, oh, Caroline, I'm having a really bad time with, say, an issue. I had my child recently and I'm feeling really low. And I go, look, I wouldn't have any personal experience. I could treat you one-to-one, but they don't want that there and then. They just want comfort. So I refer them on to maybe the Gaird in Sligo, who runs the Replenish Tribe in Sligo, or the Gaird in Bundoran, who has experienced postnatal depression. And for them, they feel that, oh, Caroline referred somebody on to me. Not to do therapy, because they're not exactly qualified hospital. They've been in the health services. And it empowers them to see that their experience is so valuable. And I always say, yes, I'm trained, I have 15 years in voluntary work, but I always refer back to my personal experience. And that empathy that I have come from my own struggle. So I get people to put a huge amount of value on what they always would have deemed a curse. You know, so I my main aim is to empower people to see that, you know, just because I'm trained in certain therapies doesn't make me, you know, a predecessor of them because they're not trained. In fact, their own experience, they're an expert by experience.
I
think that's really important in when you are in mental health.
Yes, without a doubt. It's one complicated area. And the more you kind of delve into it, the more qualifications you could try to amass. And I think that the expertise of experience is often underrated, without a doubt.
Absolutely. Because, like, you know, I'm in the north, but the girls who run the tribes over the border, they know the ins and outs of the HSE. I don't. And, you know, they're at a point now where they feel so empowered that they're sitting in on audits and things and help getting the professionals. They listen to them to hear what they find helpful or not helpful. Like, I couldn't do that, you know. And so that's where I really value other people's experiences. And I try to utilize that and I try to cultivate it a lot more.
Yeah.
So you have to be really unselfish.
Yes.
Because there's a lot of, with social media age, there's a lot of self-glory and glory hunting, and I'm sick of that. I'm really sick of that. So I try to counteract that by just, you know, really bringing attention to people who deserve recognition for their work they're doing, for their passion. And that's what I'm about.
One question that I had, it was a question that you mentioned, I think, on one of your Facebook lives, that you were something that you were asked was how to help a loved one with their mental health. Because I think it's like, when I think about myself and when I've spoken to other people, a big breakthrough is often when we get to a point where we are now 100% comfortable with kind of who we are and taking responsibility for our own mental health and our own health. But when you're, I've seen it often, and I've seen it at close quarters with my wife, who, you know, often says that she's like, you know, she's not sure that actual support for the people who have to live with somebody with mental health problems, or just in terms of, you know, what they can do practically, what they can do on a day-to-day basis. Do you have any kind of tips or advice for people who may be living with somebody with a mental health challenge or condition?
Yeah, well, I often come across people who are afraid to tell their family because their family will dismiss it or say, oh, not in my house, you don't get that from me, and they're maybe shamed and things like that. But, you know, had I listened to my parents, and they would have said, no, everybody gets those thoughts, that's normal. You know, had I listened to them, maybe I would have suffered a bit more. They didn't know. It's not that they were ashamed. They just never thought that it could be a chronic condition, and they just thought it was something normal. But it was me that took the initiative and went to the doctor and went and got diagnosed. And what I did then, my therapist gave me a handout, and the title is for people or family members of somebody living with OCD. And I went, here's what I have. This is OCD. I was diagnosed with it. You educate yourself, but the reality is this is what I have. Of course, they were receptive of it, but they'll probably never get the depths of how I suffer with it. But educating them and kind of standing up going, you may never understand. That's okay. I don't need you to, but you have to respect it. And you have to be sometimes cutthroat about that. Because when I first met my boyfriend, one of the first things I said to him was, I have a mental health disorder and I really have to go to the lengths to look after it. And that was me saying, you can take me or leave me, but this is how I am. And, you know, he's still here. But at the same time, I know people don't have that confidence to do that. But it's vital. Otherwise, they'll be, you know, oppressed by people around them or oppressed by society or stigma. And nothing is going to change unless they know the respect and the care that they deserve. Like, you don't need to be, like, when I'm having a bad day, like, my boyfriend's not a therapist and he doesn't need to be. All I have to do is talk to him, and hearing his voice is enough for me. He doesn't have to, like, tell me techniques or do this or do that. All I have to do is to be listened to and to be, you know, soothed a bit. And that's all he has to do. And that's all I expect of him. Yeah, I think it's important for family members to know that they don't have to be qualified or have intricate therapeutic interventions. It's important for them to just be there. When I went through a really, really bad time about 5-6 years ago, I was confined to the sofa. And all my mommy and daddy had to do was, my mommy made me decaf tea. My daddy lit the fire every day because it was really therapeutic. And that's all they had to do. And that really helped. And all they had to do was talk to me and just be there and listen to me. They didn't have to do anything, majestic. It's important for people not to feel a burden of responsibility to, make their loved ones better. Just be with them consistently and let them know that you're always there no matter what, and that you can talk to them, and be clear that you may not fully understand it, but that you're there anyway and that you can see their pain and you want to help them along the way.
Yeah,
Don't run away from them. Just be with them. And I know it's hard to kind of sit with someone who's maybe feeling suicidal or in the midst of a panic attack, but it's happening whether you like it or not. So you may as well be there as the best way to support someone.
That's powerful stuff. I want to maybe another few minutes just on, I have a couple of questions or shorter questions to wrap up or finish up. The first of those is if you could let people go away, people listen to this, maybe might be interested in their own positive mental health. If you could let people go away with, two or three strategies or mechanisms or tips or advice for positive mental health in their own daily lives, what would you suggest?
I always use the one FEAR as an acronym for false evidence appearing real, because your thoughts can be so powerful and we react to the thoughts and brings on anxiety. But when I'm having a bad day, I always remember that fear is falsely real and very, like they're going to happen. But if you detach yourself and almost see yourself and give yourself that self-talk and say, this is false evidence appearing real, it feels real, but it's not. And what I do is that it's this metacognition. So when I'm in my workshops, I would stand and I would show the version of me that's having a really bad thought on the precipice of an anxiety attack. And then I step out of myself and kind of talk to myself as if I'm standing beside myself. And how I'm able to do that is I'm aware of my tendency to think a certain way. So there's multitudes of unhelpful thinking styles. I have the tendency to catastrophize and black and white thinking. I familiarize myself with how I think. And now I know in any situation, I'm going to think those specific unhelpful thinking styles. So I catch them in the act. I have like a self-talk kind of dialogue that I give myself. And that's important for you to constantly, have that on hand to kind of talk yourself out, to rationalize it. Because we can't always use people for a crutch. We have to also rely on ourselves. So another thing I do is OCD. It's not me, it's my OCD. So if I have a really terrifying thought that really like dwindles my self-esteem and makes me feel bad about myself, I remember it's not me, it's my OCD. Just familiarizing yourself with how you react to certain situations and detach yourself. And when you have negative self-talk, I read somewhere that somebody says, imagine it's a roommate who's not educated, who doesn't know what they're talking about, and they're trying to tell you advice. You don't listen to them. You don't give them any attention, because any advice they give you is not going to be helpful. It's also like, I'll give you one last point. It's like somebody coming into your house, say the meter man, the man's come to read the meter. You know he has a job to do, but you don't invite him in, he's just reading the meter. Whereas you bring a friend in and you sit around and have tea or coffee. And that's okay, you bring in the good thoughts, but you don't bring in the negative thoughts. So your meter man is only there to do one thing. But if you're bringing him in and sitting him down for tea, he's not going to be very helpful other than reading the meter. So when you get a negative thought, acknowledge them and see that they're there, but don't invite them in for tea because they're not going to give you anything worthwhile. Do you know what I mean?
I like that. Yeah, I do. I like that. You've spoken a little bit about the fears you had, even going back to death anxiety. Do you have any fears now? And if you do, what is it that makes you afraid?
I think it's just, OCD thoughts can be quite sporadic. If it's not one theme, it's another. It's always the fear of losing control, or if you're overcome with that arousal of anxiety makes you feel like you're going to go through with some compulsion. But it's trusting in yourself, that knowing that you won't, that it's not indicative of the kind of person you are. All our fears would be, I kind of think, normal fears. When an intrusive thought comes into my head, I'm very aware that if me ruminating on it and trying to figure out what it's about will get me nowhere. We all have thoughts, and the nature of humans, we all want to find the bottom of it. We want a solution, we want an answer, and that's why people ruminate. So I tell myself, if I sit and ruminate on why I had this thought, I'm going to be worse off. So I just deem it an OCD thought. There's no answer to it. It has no purpose. And the thoughts will keep coming back. But a really good strategy I read too in another book was it's a bookshelf and there's this book that keeps flying off the shelf and you have to keep putting it back because you know this book, you know the ending, nothing new is going to change by you reading it. So you don't open it, you just continue to put it back on the shelf, and that's the way you treat negative thoughts and fears. So it's not to say I don't get fears or thoughts anymore. I just know that dwelling on them won't get me anywhere, and I put it on the hypothetical shelf over and over and over again.
I like it. Do you have a daily routine?
I do. Like, being female, my hormones can wreak havoc on my mental health. That's a whole other industry in itself, but it's important. But, you know, plenty of self-care during times of stress, hormones, and sometimes challenging times really help you see your strength or the strength that you build. I always use this analogy that I made up of the Russian dolls. So we're all different versions of ourselves. So me talking to you now is going to be different to the person I am when I'm with my friend being rowdy or when I'm with my niece and nephews. And it's important to remember that who we are in different environments is not always the same. We're different configurations of ourselves. And so when you are worried about the future or feeling that you're unable to cope with the onset of a stressful situation, I always say, remember, you're an army of yourself, just like the Russian dolls. Some part of you will come out and deal with that situation. That part of you, you may not be aware of. Because sometimes we find ourselves in situations where we go, you know, I did this and I totally shocked myself. In fact, I'm quite proud of myself that I did that. And that's because there's versions of ourselves that we don't even know about yet. And they will come out in stressful situations. Therefore, we will cope when the time comes. So you trust in your future self to deal with situations that you're currently afraid of. And so I always say to people, remember, you're an army of yourself. That OCD, mental health, depression version of you is a wee tiny version of you. She's way at the back. Sometimes she tries to come to the front and take order. But when you cultivate your identity and you honor yourself and you do what keeps you, so honoring yourself, honoring your needs, doing what you love, staying true to yourself will really keep you strong.
I love that. And it's a good place to almost finish. I have a couple more shorter questions.
I'll keep the answer short now.
It's okay. And I'm really, really great. I think it's been amazing. And I'm really grateful for your time, Carly.
No, I'm honored to be here.
It's wonderful. So a couple of final questions. What do you know now that you wish you knew when you were 15?
That it's okay to feel like this. It's not an indication of anything bad happening and you're not a bad person. It's a condition that's quite normal. And, you know, it's hard to say because, you know, I think I had to endure what I had to endure to be where I am today. So one thing, I could change it. Another thing, maybe changing it would impede on my growth. So if anything, I would just normalize it. Normalize it, say it's fine, really make it non-clinical when, you know, talking about it, and just that I will exceed my expectations of myself.
Wonderful. Two more questions. What's your definition of happiness?
Contentment. I say you don't strive for happiness, you strive for contentment. Happiness is like anger. It's a temporary emotion. And happiness is what keeps people buying things, you know, keeps capitalism growing. Contentment is knowing, you know, I'm not the richest or the most beautiful or the smartest or the most healthiest, but I'm me and I'm okay with that. And that comes from a lot of self-introspection. So the definition of happiness is contentment for me.
I love that. Final question. What are you, Caroline McMenamin, in spring of 2019, what are you most excited about right now?
Just the growing tribes of Replenish, just seeing people becoming part of the tribe, seeing people, you know, anybody who comes near me gets a wave ring. And it's these wee rings that I make, and they're just in the shape of an ocean wave. And they always know when they have that ring that they're part of a tribe, and that Replenish tribe, where everyone has a mental health issue, and it's fun and it's fine and it's a place of refuge and it's okay. I want that to grow.
No, absolutely. And I wish you the very best of luck with that. Before I let you go, where can people go to find out more about you, Carly McMenamin, and about Replenish and about anything else you have going on?
I'm on Instagram, onred_Duchess, and Duchess is spelt with a T. I know it's kind of controversial, but it's better for search engine optimization purposes because the most widely spelt way of Duchess is with a T.
Really?
Replenish.online, because I run programs in schools and workplaces and communities. And then on Facebook, I'm the Red Duchess on Facebook, and there I would do live videos. There's a whole playlist of videos and me talking about different topics and just generally acting a whack to your time. So, because if you don't cry, you have to laugh, you know.
Absolutely. Caroline, it's been fantastic talking to you. I wish you the very, very best of luck with continuing growth and success of Replenish and spreading your message. And yeah, I wish you luck and thank you so much for joining me today.
I'm so honored and delighted. Thank you so much, Shane.
Shane here again, and thank you so much again for listening to this episode. I got so much out of it talking to Caroline. She is such an impressive person, and I'm just really looking forward to her message getting to as many people as possible. So if you heard something in this episode that really struck a chord with you, or something that you feel other people around you or friends or family or anybody else needs to know, I'd be so grateful if you could share it out by taking a screenshot of the episode on your phone or wherever you've listened to it, or sharing it out on whatever social media you prefer. All other episodes are available on my website at shanebreslin.com. There's a button at the top, or link at the top, podcast. So all other episodes of the Life Well Lived podcast are there. And you can find them just by going to shanebreslin.com and clicking on podcast. Again, thank you so much for being here. Thank you so much for taking the time. And I'll be back again very, very soon with another episode of the Life Well Lived podcast.